Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dr. Selby Wynn Schwartz about her book, The Bodies of Others, Drag Dances and Their Afterlives, which was published this year by the University of Michigan Press. And to anyone listening to this in the future, that means 2019. The Bodies of Others covers four decades of drag dances and explores the politics of gender in motion. Selby, welcome to New Books in Gender Studies.
Thank you so much.
Well, and before we start talking about the book, could you tell us a bit, about yourself, your trajectory, and what led you to write this book?
Yes, I can tell you the story of beginning this book. I think it's a kind of a love story, actually. So it has a lot of parts that I didn't see coming. And it began when I was finishing grad school. I was at the University of California, Berkeley, doing a doctorate in comparative literature with a joint doctorate in medieval studies. So I was reading a lot of dead languages. And I was very happy. I was happy teaching. I was happy doing this kind of research. I was working on medieval poetry and performance. So in a way, I was already quite interested in gender and performance. And the crossings over between those, but several hundred years before what I'm working on now. So I was just finishing, I was in the last semester of writing and teaching, and I was teaching a class in comparative literature that was about gender and performance, and specifically about dance. And it happened, luckily, to be a semester when the Ballet Trocadero in Monte Carlo was coming to perform at UC Berkeley. There's a large theater there at Zellerbach Hall. And I thought, who better to teach my students about gender and performance than the ballerinas of Les Ballets Trocadero de Monte Carlo? They know so much more than I do about this topic. So I had a small grant from a kind of arts in the classroom group at Berkeley. And it allowed me to invite the artistic director, Tori Dobrin, of the Ballet Trocadero to come and speak with my students, and also to take my students to the dress rehearsal of the company. And I think all of the things that are true about, and maybe even cliched about this kind of love story happened then. So I fell, like a coup de foudre, lightning strike, moment of absolutely falling in love and thinking, oh, this is what I want to do next. I just want to be with this company. I just love them. So I went to Tori and I said all those things. And to his absolute credit, he didn't, back away from me slowly. He was so kind and generous and said, well, I really appreciate that you're so devoted to that. What do you think you would do with us? So they're based in New York City, and I was based in the Bay Area in California. And I had no answer to that question. And I realized how presumptuous it was of me to just fall in love without having anything to bring. So I said, I'm right. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. I'll try and, getting a doctorate in comparative literature, and I could read dead languages. I didn't really know what I could bring. I didn't know that much about dance, and certainly not about ballet. And I only knew a little bit about drag, mostly from, the 13th century. So I said that I would go away for a year and try and learn something useful. And I began to work with a ballet company in the Bay Area, Alonzo King Lines Ballet. And I feel, again, quite fortunate that I found them. I was really just looking for a ballet company so I could learn something about the world. And instead I found Alonzo King and Lines. And that was a tremendous learning opportunity, because all of a sudden I was working with deeply thoughtful artists, not just a kind of, ballet company where it's like, okay, all the girls should get in line and do what they're told, but a company, a really diverse company, thinking so deeply about what ballet could be. So I learned more than I had bargained for. And at the end of the year, the people in the company, the creative director, asked me they were a little puzzled why I was there. And they said, what do you really want to do here? And I said, oh, I want to be the company manager. And no one wanted to do that. It's a rough job being a company manager. So they let me, try that. And I was a company manager for a year. And then I started doing things that I was actually better at, like doing some of the writing and research for new ballets, and doing a lot of the tour managing in Europe, because I can also speak French and Italian, so that was helpful on tours in Europe. And I stayed with Alonzo King Lines Ballet on and off for several years, and really, I learned so much in that time. So eventually, I did come back to Tori Dobrin at Le Ballet Trocadero and asked him if I could start, writing about the company. Now that I knew a little more, and he again so kindly and generously allowed me to sit in on rehearsals, and I accompanied the Trocadero on some of their tours, and got to speak with the dancers and with Tori, and with the quite amazing production people backstage who you don't get to see so much in stories about, dancers and choreographers, what happens on stage. And the book really grew out of that love. So as soon as I started learning things about one company, then I started seeing what was in the world of drag dance. And I was amazed that somebody else hadn't already written a book about it. And that may be my particular perspective, but it seemed so fascinating to me. It brings up so many questions that go beyond people who are into dance, or people who ask about gender, or people who are interested in theater. Seem like some of the largest questions that we have about what gender is and how it sits in our bodies and how it is read by other people are being worked out by these artists. And so the whole project became about learning from the artists how to understand that and how to write about that.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating project. So I'm curious about your title, right? What do you mean by the afterlives of drag dances?
Yeah, I didn't begin with that idea. I learned that from the artists. So when I started talking to people, or actually when I began asking them questions about how they understood what they were doing, they would often use words with me like seance or haunting or sort of hosting these ghostly bodies in their bodies, or channeling, or they would talk about memories of dancers who, who were no longer alive and who belonged to these historical periods that they felt were very present, and not only present, but sort of inhabiting them. And that's where that idea came from, that in dance studies, there's kind of a long and now maybe tired debate about is dance ephemeral? Does it just flame into existence in the moment that it's being performed and then flame out again? Or does it continue and can you preserve it and things like that. And I thought this was, and here I'm following the thinking of a performance studies scholar named Andrew Lepecki, who's at NYU, that was not such a helpful way to look at dance and the question of ephemerality, because the artists were telling me they didn't see it that way. They saw it in terms of having afterlives that were living, of dancers who were not them, having afterlives that lived in their bodies, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I really appreciate on the book, is that it's not necessarily a comprehensive history of drag dances, but you give us like these deep, insightful readings of these five different bodies of work in drag dance, and you then frame them using these different concepts. So in that way, I think your book serves, at least for me, as a template, and it should be really, you know, interesting to anyone who is investigating performances that defy, you know, gender and sexuality normativity. And one of the things that I enjoyed the most reading it is that you open your chapters with these really evocative descriptions of the dances and performances. I was wondering, where does that language come from? Are you a dancer yourself?
I often get asked that. And it's very kind of you to say all of these things. I can answer the question about where does the writing at the beginning of the chapters come from. I think I'm a writer, and writing is my way of processing things, of seeing. It's how I take things in, and what became the beginnings of the chapters were things that I was writing while I was watching grainy video or sitting in rehearsal, so that I could try to avoid the word capture here, but so that I could let it imprint on me, and the way that I then produce something from what is imprinted on me is often through writing. And also I like to read vivid dance writing. I appreciate dance writers who aren't doing so much judging and evaluation, and are trying to do more understanding and reflecting and engaging with the artists, or doing the best they can to tell other people what it seems like it looks like. That's always there's always a risk there. So yes, I often get asked if I am a dancer, but I'm not a dancer. I've got, you know, physical practices of my own, but I have spent a lot of time now with dancers. I do now know some backstage things that I didn't know before.
Gotcha. Yeah, because you really bring us to these performances with you. And I ask this because there is a quote you mentioned from Martha Graham, where she critiques, right, people who need words to understand what moves bodies. And to a certain extent, that's what you're doing here. You are using these words to translate to your readers what is moving those bodies, and to people like me who are not dancers and who haven't experienced those performances, it was really a fantastic experience. So I was wondering, how did you decide on the scope of the project, right? Why this particular time frame, and how did you select the performances and performers that you talk about?
Well, this is related to the question about falling in love with the Ballet Trocadero. It had to begin roughly in 1974, because that's when the Ballet Trocadero began. So in a way, that's very arbitrary, but in a way, it's very helpful. It means that many of the artists are still around and can talk to you, and you can learn from them. So I kind of began with that as a sense that, as you said, it's not a comprehensive history of all drag dances for all time in all cultures. There's a book about drag in theater, and at least one that tries to do something more like that. But I'm not that kind of writer, I think. So I wanted to try to go more deeply into a very small number of dances that I thought were illustrative. And when I began looking for drag dances in that time frame, it very quickly narrowed in a way I hadn't expected, because although there is a rich culture of drag performance, much of it is club performance or community performance or also private performance. So there are traditions, you know, of course, the ballroom tradition, but also all kinds of club drag and long-running parties and theatrical drag that are not concert dance. And so limiting it to drag dances that were being staged as concert dance, so like more or less in black box or proscenium theaters for paying audiences who were seeing this in the category of dance, like that it would be reviewed in the dance sections of newspapers and things like that, actually produced a surprisingly small number of dances. And I tried to write about those. And of course, as soon as I started writing, I realized how much the artists were often in relation to each other. And that was part of what produced a way to write about the afterlives, is that people would say to me, oh, my drag foremothers are, and it would be someone else I had tried to write about. Or, of course, you know, the history of Kazuo Ono in Buto, which has deeply influenced me, even for somebody who was not working in Buto in any way.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain this relation that you make in your introduction between what the body looks like and what the body can do and how gender is performed in these drag dances?
I can try. This is a distinction I was trying to make throughout the book. And I think I'm always looking for different language for this. But a lot of the ways that drag has historically been taken in the sense of looked at or read has to do with surfaces. It understands gender as a surface and the body as a surface, and is predicated often on legibility from the outside. So you can look at someone and say, oh, that person is a woman, or as often also been said in toxic ways, that person is not a real woman. And I'm really trying to get away from that in this book. So the idea of what the body can do is, that's not my idea. It's a phrase that gets tossed around a lot, I think, from Deleuze. And there's now a book by Ben Spatz, in fact, called What a Body Can Do. So it's popular beyond my use of it. But I use it because I'm trying to get away from the sense that we need to stay on the evaluative surfaces of bodies, what bodies look like, and say, oh, this body looks like that, therefore it is that. And rather to say, what can this body do? What can we do with the bodies we have? And I ask myself that question a lot in different contexts, some of them political. So sometimes what we can do with the bodies we have is we can change them in different ways. There are possible transitions and prosthetics for bodies. And some things about bodies are that way for you as a person living in your body. And that has to be, to me, part of what bodies are, not just a tolerated part, but a fundamental part that we accept. We all have these bodies. We all have these bodies that age. We all have these bodies that are different from each other and will be different from themselves over time. So I tried to write about drag from that perspective as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, there's one special passage on your book that stuck with me, and it inspired the way I'm approaching my own investigation now. As you say, and I'm quoting you, that when what is supposed to be biologically given is performed, gender is pried away from its ontological certainty. So do you think, what would be the role of drag dances in an anti-heteronormative gender politics?
Well, I think in that particular instance, I was trying to explain something about a category of drag that has had different names over time. Sometimes gets called being a faux queen or being a bio queen, which has some, both of those terms maybe have some problems, but it's, when someone who's assigned female at birth, so who's a cisgender woman, is in drag, is in feminine drag, or sometimes high femme drag. And that in itself for some people is an astonishing concept. And the question that arises is, how can you be in drag as a woman if you're really a woman? And it's, you can ask the same question to men. How can you be a drag queen king if you're already assigned male at birth? So to start there, that in fact, whatever they want to call themselves, faux queens exist and are queens. So that's what I meant by the ontological certainty is there is clearly a performing of a kind of gender affect, no matter what your body is assigned at birth. And so I guess if there is a way in which that's part of a anti-heteronormative politics, it's saying that drag is a crystallization and an intensification of a way that gender manifests, and it's a clear performance. People choose to perform it, but in the sense that that Judith Butler theorized about gender having performative elements, I think that kind of faux king or faux queen mode helps us to see what's not ontologically certain about gender for all of us, those of us who do drag and those of us who don't. Mm-hmm.
So, and as you know, there's been this long debate over whether drag queens are gender conservatives or gender revolutionaries. Where do you stand in that debate?
Yes, I think this is the one about is dance ephemeral. So I think, you know, drag is a kind of technology in that sense. So some people who have used it to reinforce misogynist, very problematic, transphobic boundaries that I hope we're all trying to get rid of. And some people have used it in beautiful, and sometimes liberating ways for themselves and for their communities. So I would love to say, of course, drag is always revolutionary, but unfortunately that's just not true. You know, So I guess I'm hopeful that more people will be able to use it for revolutionary purposes, but certainly it has been sometimes used to exacerbate things that are already bad about gender normativity.
Yeah, as I was mentioning earlier, the book follows, you know, a structure where you, in each chapter, you discuss this body of dance and particular performers, and you frame them within particular concepts. And as a historian, I was particularly intrigued by one of the definitions when you talk about drag dance as a form of embodied historiography or an action history. What do you mean by that?
Well, action history is a term that I borrowed from one of the artists, Catherine Cabin, who dances among, she's a choreographer in her own right, and also, does drag in different ways. And so I owe that idea to her. But the idea of embodied historiography, I think, is something that I think all of the artists I'm writing about would recognize as part of their practices, whether they use those words or not. So historiography being not just history itself, but a way of recording history, a kind of perspective or style even of recording history. And it's related to this kind of slightly haunted idea, I think, of the séance or of channeling, is that if you are doing drag in this way as a dancer, dancing is already so embodied, and you're taking the histories of past dances, often that have been lost or that are precarious in some way, and re-embedding them, which takes a lot of work and discipline in your own body. And to me, that seems incredibly generous, this willingness to take, for example, in the case of the Trocadero, to take the what is left, the memories, the grief also of so many dancers who were lost to AIDS in the company and around the company, and to try to remember them by reincorporating them in the way that you dance, in the way that you take class, in the way that you perform. It seems like a quite radical understanding of what it means to remember or to commemorate, and very generous.
Mm-hmm. So let's just try to walk through the chapters and, you know, the performances and the concepts that you discuss here. In the first one, you are talking about codes and systems of sign and how the dancers you're discussing here can communicate to audiences without necessarily relying on elaborate costumes or makeup, that a male body person can be read as a female character. Please explain that to folks who haven't yet had an opportunity to read your book or to see these performances.
Okay, yeah. So I'm writing in this chapter about one of the drag dances that probably has been most written about in this context. So that's Mark Morris's Dido and Aeneas. And Dido and Aeneas is a dance set to opera, to this Henry Purcell piece. And Mark Morris, when he first made the piece, decided that he would dance both of the female lead roles himself, so the queenly Dido and the witchy, malevolent sorceress. And he, I think, visibly had a great time doing that. They're challenging roles technically. They're also theatrical. So Mark Morris, not always, but often, makes choreography where there's a kind of legibility to the gesture. So the gestures are keyed to the words of the libretto, meaning that, you know, if somebody is making the sign, if the libretto is saying something about happiness, the dancers will often make some kind of sign that visibly looks like happiness. Mm-hmm. And sometimes even they'll you know, sort of act with their faces, they're happy. So this makes the dances that are like that in some way very accessible. You know, it's like you can imagine one critic, Jonah Cacella, said in a loving but kind of a critical way, it's like I'm a little teapot. So every word goes with it. So not every word in Dido and Aeneas is key to a gesture, but many are. And the gendered words, so words like queen or hero, are particularly important because Mark Morris is a male-bodied person who is a cis gay man, and he's performing two female roles, and his costume is not very gendered. So he had to find ways of communicating that people in the audience were supposed to read him as a queen or a sorceress, depending on which character he was performing at the time. And so luckily, though, there's a whole history of very gendered codes for things. We have this in our lives, which is, it's culturally specific, but you can think of them, in our cultures as being things like who crosses their legs, who bends their arm at the wrist, who takes up space on the subway, things like that, who shakes hands, who waves in what way, what do their fingers do, all these kinds of things. In ballet, they're even more codified. There's a whole, you know, princess hero vocabulary, and he borrowed some of the signs, Mark Morris borrowed some of the signs for those things from ballet pantomime, which is super clear about, like, this is the prince and this is the princess, or things like that. So it was slightly more complicated for him to differentiate the queen he was playing from the sorceress he was playing. But he's also a very theatrical dancer, and he put a lot of affect into those roles. So Dido as the queen is very queenly. She's sorrowful. She's solemn. She's noble. She's, tormented in a queenly, harrowed way. And the witch is, the sorceress is extremely witchy, and she cackles and she trills her fingers along things. And she, she has an evil smile and things like that. So there were, under the sort of broad feminine, masculine gender codes, he also was working with kinds of feminine codes, in order to differentiate those two female characters.
Mm-hmm. So then in the following chapter, we meet this male-bodied performer who embodies one of dance's greatest divas. And this you discuss, as you were talking earlier, in terms of a seance or hosting. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, that chapter is about Richard Mouve. And I actually don't know these days how Richard is identifying, but when I was writing about Richard, he was using he, him pronouns. So I'm going to use those. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly how he's identifying now. So, but in the time I was writing about Richard, he is maybe most famous as well for channeling Martha Graham. And those are his words. He often uses the language of channeling and hosting in the seance. So that's something that I really learned from Richard, that kind of language. It's the way that he relates to Martha Graham, that she is the kind of, that they're kind of Martha together, Richard and Martha Graham. And his history is fascinating. I think it comes out of not only a time in New York when club drag was really thriving and quite experimental, but then he's also trained as a dancer, and he's a performance studies scholar and a filmmaker in his own right. So he has quite a lot of resources to draw on in theorizing for himself what this series of performances, there have been many Martha at whatever theater he's at. And I think it spilled over for him into other things as well. He had a big project on Anna Mendieta, which also has a lot of the language of the uncanny and the eerie and the ghostly and the haunted and the revisiting.
Yes. And so next we learned about this aging Japanese butoh dancer who embodied an Argentinian ballerina. And here you explore this within the concept of admiring as a form of embodiment and speculative historiography. Tell us about that.
Well, the butoh dancer is Kazuo Ono. And he's one of the co-founders of butoh. And very late in his life, after he had already sort of retired from the stage, he had a strange encounter with an abstract painting that reminded him, maybe reminded is not strong enough, that sparked in him a memory of a woman named La Argentina, who had been a Spanish dancer that he had seen decades before and had actually never mentioned. But it came out at this late juncture of his life that he had been more than deeply moved by her performance, that something about it had stayed inside of him. And it sort of uses a lot of the language of gestating and this kind of embryonic thing. So already there's a sort of gender fluidity in his language about La Argentina. And he made a dance, probably his most famous dance, called Admiring La Argentina. And he doesn't, although the sometimes it gets described as things like impersonating La Argentina, he used the language of admiring. And so I follow him in that. But it's very intriguing what he means by admiring. He's very attached to dresses, but he's not very attached to the precise kinds of movements that she made. And their bodies are very different, and their trainings are very different, and the time frames in which they're performing are very different, Kazuo Ono and Argentina. So it's not there's not an exactness to that that is about resemblance or looking like. Instead, the basis, I think, for his idea of admiring has to do with something that accounts for the difference between them, but doesn't deny that there is a relation, that he is in some way incorporating her, the history of his memory of her, at least. Mark Franco writes about this as well. He's a dance scholar. And the idea of speculative historiography is something that comes more from the way that chapter ends and from Tragil Harrell, who is still making work and made a piece about Kazuo Ono admiring La Argentina called The Return of La Argentina. So this chain is going on. That's across, three quite different bodies, many decades of time, and three very different traditions of dance training between those three people. And Tragil Harrell, like Richard Mouve, is someone who is quite capable of theorizing his own approach to historiography and to embodiment as well.
Yeah, it's great. I really appreciate that you use their own concepts, their own ideas, right, about those dances. You respected them in that way. So then we get your original muses, right? you talk about their work as genealogies for a ballet. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So ballet is is in many ways such an ossified form, and that has endearing parts. And I think the Trocadero ballerinas are endeared of what is endearing about the ossification of ballet. So all of the tutus and the kind of ballerina insanity. And then it has really, really problematic aspects, especially in terms of race and class, and it's, yeah, gender normativity. When I'm talking about genealogies for ballet, in part I'm talking about the way that ballet itself conceives of its transmission. So, who receives from the master ballet choreographer is allowed to continue the well-protected history of the master ballet. It's pretty heteronormative, and it's been damaging for lots of potential ballerinas, among other things. So I admired so much about the Trocadero that not only do they change the structure, the sort of lineage that they think they come from. So they come from multiple lineages. They come out of a theater history around Charles Ludlum and the Ridiculous Theater. But they also come out of this time when a kind of ballet was sort of dying, the end of Russian ballet, as a as a form that was sort of splintering off into tiny little companies that were fighting with each other. And so they claim for themselves these multiple histories, and that in itself is a kind of non-heteronormative genealogy. And then just the way that they think they have the right to inherit ballet and be inclusive about it for others is, to me, a really admirable way of conceiving something that can often be quite dark because it relies on things like bloodlines, and those things in there backstages are quite racialized and normative. And so I love about them that they make these kind of queer genealogies, and they're mm-hmm. so much more inclusive and possible for people to participate in.
Yeah. And so when your final chapter, it discusses, right, something you were talking about earlier, the work of a faux or bio queen. Mm-hmm. And this you relate with the concept of realness. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, realness is a term that comes out of ballroom history. And so it's a term that, you know, belongs to the history of queer and trans, Black and brown communities. The person I'm writing about is a white cis woman named Monique Jenkinson, who has for many, many years been a faux queen. And her name as a drag queen is Phonique, because her first name is Monique. So her term for what she is a faux queen. And we talked together. She lives in San Francisco, and we've known each other for many years, about why terms like bio queen are difficult for people, because it seems to refer queenness and some genders that are attendant upon that to something biological. And you know, as we know, this gets into some fairly transphobic ideas about what bodies are allowed to be. So that's where the idea of Phonique and the faux queen comes from. I think her playfulness around being faux comes partly out of some small resistance from male-bodied drag queens in the very, very early years, who would say things like, "You're not a real drag queen." And I think as awareness around gender inclusivity has improved, at least in places like San Francisco, that is much rarer. You know, I mean, there were early faux queen. There was a faux queen pageant, I think, in 1995 in San Francisco. But now there are so many more possibilities for who can be a queen or a king. And I'm hoping that that trend continues, that it becomes much more inclusive for people, whatever their genders are and however they imagine those genders.
Well, you'll be happy to hear that this year, one of Mexico's biggest drag competitions, it's called La Mastraga. Alexis mm-hmm. Tres XL, a bio queen, won the competition. And she was also voted the best Mexican drag queen this year. So yeah, yay. Yeah.
Thank you for telling me that.
Yeah. So, well, yes, as you note here, you note that we have enriched our vocabularies about gender and sexuality. And you suggested that maybe we should start rethinking the term drag. How do you think we can or should do that now?
I think just in the way that you just explained, actually. So I'm fond of the term drag, and many people do identify as drag kings and drag queens. It's got an important political history. Sylvia Rivera identified as a drag queen, and you know, she's now an icon of trans history. And there's sometimes, rightly, kind of a push forward to change our vocabulary so that there are more inclusive terms for the ways that people really identify and live their lives. But personally, I'm hoping that what drag means will move forward as we move forward, that it won't just be discarded. I think it's mm-hmm. a term that has been important for people. And I feel like we're hearing this a bit more now from people who are trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming who are saying, not for everyone, but for some people, drag is a way of experimenting with gender. It's like a, it's a space of possibility. And if that's part of someone's transition, part of someone's gender, part of someone's process or embodiment, then I think drag is still quite important. It's still a space that's open for experimentation and sort of moving through what gender might look like on a given day for someone.
Yeah, and this book is so timely because it seems like drag is everywhere now, right? It's mainstream in a way that I think, I don't know, it's probably unprecedented. I don't know. Yeah. Well, you had a Trocadero ballerina almost won the latest installment in RuPaul's mm-hmm. Drag Race, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you make?
Yeah, it's hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about drag without talking about RuPaul. Yes.
So what do you make of this current, you know, popularization, mainstreaming, and also commodification of drag? Do you think it can maintain its subversive and political role?
I am actually curious about what you think about this as well, because I think in this way, concert dance is a little bit removed. I mean, as you say, these worlds are linked, Yeah, I think here I have more of a vague hope than an actual prediction. So I hope that you know, drag continues to belong to the communities that it belongs to, and isn't just, you know, a feature of like late capitalist reality television. But RuPaul, you know, has been also kind of a gatekeeper in both the good and the bad sense for the visibility and the profitability of drag. So, you know, it's a way for people to have careers in drag, and I recognize that. But at the same time, it's, you know, he's been sometimes transphobic, and, you know, the community of drag queens mostly, and especially trans women, has tried to be in conversation, I think, with him around that, so that this very important, highly visible forum for drag doesn't just reproduce a really limited idea of drag. But I'm curious if you have hope about that.
I'm really curious to see where we go next, right? Because on the one hand, as you said, we have RuPaul as the gatekeeper. But then we see people trying to, you know, take the queen's place, dethrone her, so to speak. You have new competitions that are way more inclusive. There is another mm-hmm. one that's gaining traction now called Dragula that has the first drag king as well, competing with the drag queens mm-hmm. for the spot. So I don't know. I'm going to be interested and excited to see where this goes next.
Yeah.
And so since this is a podcast for and by people who like books, I like to conclude mm-hmm. with my three book club questions. The first one okay. is if there was any particular book that inspired or informed the body of others that you would recommend to our listeners.
It's always hard for me to recommend one book. I think that's a problem being a reader. Can I recommend more
Absolutely.
Than one?
Absolutely.
Well, I have to say that Monique Jenkinson is writing her own autobiography, so there will be what the title will be, but there will be some kind of memoirs of Phonique coming out. And I believe that, you know, the writers, that the artists and particular dancers who are often told that they don't have the same access to language that writers do, I think they should get to write their own theories and understandings of these things. So that's one forthcoming that I am excited to see in the world. I mean, I owe debts to lots of earlier scholarship on drag and theater. You know, obviously Judith Butler was one of the people who theorized what drag and gender and performance might be And I particularly like bodies that matter in that sense, and also undoing gender. I think I owe a lot to Jose Munoz for not only theorizing this kind of performance, queer performance, performance about gender, but also being such a wicked and charming writer who got so close to the people he was writing about. And I aspire to that kind of love, I guess. Sometimes he would use that word. And then I would just like to acknowledge how much I owe to somebody that I often co-write with, Max Crandall, who's a poet and a playwright, and also somebody who didn't start out as a dance person and has become one. And yeah, he's got a book forthcoming from Future Poem. So I guess those are two forthcoming books and a debt that I owe to someone whose writing I really admire.
Oh, wonderful. So, and during the process of researching this, right, and writing, did you come across any story or a subject or a character that, you know, you didn't have time or space here to discuss, but you wish someone else would write a book about?
Well, there's so many. I think that's hard. I would love to see more work on Katie Pyle's Valez Company. I think their work is not recognized enough as a ballet company that is actively featuring trans people, lesbian people, gender nonconforming people. And I just think they don't get enough funding or recognition, and I would love to see that change. And there was a very early ballerina in the Trocadero's history named Anthony Basse, who was a Black ballerina at a time when there were not many Black ballerinas, and from all accounts was just incredibly talented and charismatic and quite brilliant. And yeah, if I had an extra decade, I would write a biography of Anthony Basse.
Wonderful. And what are you working on next?
I'm interested in another drag figure who is also maybe under-recognized, who's Italian, named Leopoldo Fregoli, who lived kind of on the cusp when live performance was being blended with the beginnings of cinema. And he was Italian and was very famous in his time, but I actually found him in a footnote in a history of early cinema when I was doing research for a chapter that I wrote about Catherine Galasso's Bring on the Lumiere project. And that footnote, I guess, is another one of those love stories where I thought, oh, how is this possible that this drag artist is so little known in English? And so now I'm quite interested in Leopoldo Fregoli.
Good, good. Well, I'm looking forward to that. And I hope when it's out, you consider coming back to talk to us.
That's very kind of you.
Selby, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And
thank you.
Okay. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Gender Studies. I just spoke to Selby Wynn Schwartz about her book, The Bodies of Others, Drag Dances and Their Afterlives. It was published earlier this year by the University of Michigan Press. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.